It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. The new movie, Black Mass, starring Johnny Depp, is the story of the notorious criminal James Whitey Bulger and his relationship with key figures in the Boston FBI office. The movie is based on the book, Black Mass, written by former Boston Globe reporters Dick Lair and Gerard O'Neill. Their coverage of Whitey Bulger has lasted decades. And we welcome Dick Lair to the program. Dick, thanks for being with us today.
Sure, good to be with you.
When Whitey Bulger went on trial, he owned up to a number of crimes, but one thing he didn't admit was being an FBI informant. He admitted to a bunch of terrible stuff, but why not that?
Well, I think in his universe, in his world, some of the things, crimes he owned up to are badges of honor. But it's the ultimate dishonor to be known as a rat or informant. And that was something that he had worked on all those years he had been, in fact, an FBI informant by insisting, for example, that the FBI agents never refer to him as a informant, but refer to him as a consultant, as a liaison. It's all wordplay and kind of mental gymnastics so that he could somehow spin and be comfortable within his own skin with the bottom line, which was that he was a rat.
In 1988, when you were working for the Boston Globe, you reported for the first time that Bulger was an FBI informant. What tipped you off to that information?
Well, I was part of a team of reporters that in the late 80s set out to simply tell this fascinating story, what we called the Tale of Two Brothers. Whitey Bulger, who was at the top of his gang in the underworld, and his younger brother, Bill. Bill Bulger was a president of the Massachusetts State Senate and probably the most powerful pal. The two brothers had grown up in a housing project in the same bedroom in South Boston, and it was a fascinating story that had never really been assembled and put together. That was our starting point, but when we got into the Whitey side of things and his Houdini-like powers to always be avoiding law enforcement and ever being arrested, we kept hearing from others in law enforcement that something's not quite right. No one is this good, this elusive. And, you know, that's what set us on the trail that ultimately led us to the fact that Whitey was an FBI informant, that the Bureau was protecting him, enabling him, and it was sort of unthinkable and unfathomable at the time because of Whitey's public persona as being this mob and crime boss and ultimate stand-up guy. It was quite a revelation.
Was the Whitey-FBI partnership something that wouldn't have been possible were it not for the neighborhood ties between FBI agent John Connolly and Whitey Bulger?
I think you're right, because I think Whitey Bulger was so smart and wary of the underworld game and, you know, what's going on out there. And John Connolly, the FBI agent, his handler, had grown up in South Boston and had a personal connection. I think that was crucial to making this deal happen. And Connolly was working. The FBI had a program where agents were encouraged to develop underworld informants. So that's why Connolly was out there. I don't think Whitey would have taken the bait or at least begun the discussions that led to the unholy alliance if not for the sense that he could trust Connolly, we're from the same neighborhood, and actually control Connolly because Connolly was so much younger.
You titled the book with the term Black Mass, which is an inversion of the ritual Catholic term, a deal with the devil.
Yep.
What is it about that community, that Southie community, the Boston Irish Catholic culture, that so informed Bulger's own form of ethics in determining who he would inform on and who he wouldn't and how he positioned himself?
Well, it's a neighborhood that has a lot of pride and it has a really positive side, but it also can be a negative side in the sense that it can be so insular and it creates an us against the world kind of mentality. And I think Whitey sort of grew up in that ambiance, but I think he manipulated it. He exploited it because in the end, everything was always about Whitey Bulger. He's a psychopath, a narcissist, and he would use some of these values of loyalty, pride, and all those things to make people serve him as opposed to maybe the neighborhood's greater good. And that was a really strategic technique of his that helps explain his power.
You mentioned how Connolly had a kind of autonomy. And I think one thing that should be pointed out is that these FBI agents were given that. They weren't just rogue in their actions, going out, cultivating these informants and protecting them, as Connolly and others in the FBI did of Whitey Bulger. but individual FBI agents were allowed to make their own deals without seeking approval from higher-ups.
Well, actually, according to the program, on paper, it seemed like there were built-in checks and balances. And you're right, agents were, as I said, under J. Edgar Hoover, encouraged to develop underworld informants so that they could go after the Bureau's number one priority, which was the Italian La Cosa Nostra. This goes back to the 60s. And they were given a lot of room to run in cultivating those informants. But on paper, there were supposed to be regular evaluations, regular assessments to make sure that power balance was the way it was supposed to be, meaning the criminal is informing to the agency and the FBI agent handlers in charge. But in this instance, which erupted into the worst informant scandal in the Bureau's history, it went beyond the agent handler John Conley. The supervisor John Morris, who was supposed to be that on-the-ground oversight, was also corrupted by Bulger. Whitey was smart. I mean, he compromised a whole bunch of FBI agents so that they, in effect, were part of his gang. And when you do that, you know, it's all about the execution on the ground. And if you do that, you're undermining and crippling whatever systemic checks and balances are supposed to be working.
Well, the pitch that was initially given to Whitey by John Conley was, listen, there's the Italian gang and there's a territorial dispute. You work with them, but not entirely. Whitey's Winter Hill gang. And if you give me information on La Cosa Nostra, we'll help you out. And so it seemed to be a no-lose situation. But I don't know if you can easily explain the relationship between the Winter Hill gang and La Cosa Nostra and how Whitey could get this information but still use it against people that were kind of his enemies but not.
Yeah, Whitey and his associates always had this sort of dangerous dance with the mafia, which was positioned in the north end of Boston. Kind of a love-hate thing. Sometimes Whitey and those guys, they were in business with the mafia. Other times they were not. But in the end, they were rivals for the underworld supremacy. And Whitey and his closest associate named Steve Fleming, who was also an informant, had the kind of intelligence that in an ongoing way was useful to the FBI in its crusade against La Cosa Nostra. It has to also be said that, you know, Whitey also, you know, he just didn't restrict it to the La Cosa Nostra. I mean, over the his files are peppered with information that he sometimes gave against people who he's insisted he would never rat on, you know. And so, I mean, you know, Whitey works really hard to try to reclaim and restore this sort of myth about himself as being the ultimate gangster. But the verdicts are in, and the evidence is overwhelming. The court rulings, the judicial rulings, the congressional hearings, I mean, it's a mountain of evidence that shows him to be the monster that he truly is and also to be the, you know, double-dealing crime boss that he's trying to deny.
This relationship between the FBI and Bulger was a mutually beneficial one for some time. But some of the lengths that the FBI agents like Conley and Dick Morris went to protect Bulger really do step over the line.
They were lawless. I mean, Morris and Conley ended up being gangsters. It is another way of defining their misconduct.
For instance, what were the tip-off murders?
Yeah, the tip-off. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the agents who enabled and then protected Whitey got into this pattern of when they learned of other investigations or other criminal informants who were informing against Whitey, the agents were providing that intelligence to Whitey Bulger. And, you know, he's a hands-on killer. His solution to problems and danger like that is to kill. So there are a series of three or four murders that have become known as the tip-off murders. These were murders that Whitey Bulger either committed himself or ordered as a result from information that Conley and Morris and the FBI provided him about someone else who posed a danger to him. It's jaw-dropping in its horror.
In the book, this factual account that you've written, when we're introduced to John Conley, he seems to be an ambitious FBI agent who's pretty good at his job. He captured a big fish in getting a source in Whitey Bulger. But by the end of that relationship, of course, no, Conley, you know, went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
He was taking money. He was being bribed. And the relationship between him and Whitey was more than just informant and agent. In your mind, was Conley always just a little bit corrupt? Or was there a tipping point where Whitey made him basically work for him?
I think almost from the get-go. I mean, that was one of the questions as the information tumbled out over the years that helped journalists and the courts sort of put together the history of this unholy alliance. is sort of, when did Connolly go bad? Was there a tipping point? And I think the records now show that, you know, they cut their deal in 1975, and that was a big, big moment for John Connolly. The records now show that within a matter of months, John Connolly gave Whitey that information about another informant that led to what was became the first tip-off murder. So it went bad real fast, which makes you think that Connolly was either way over his head, or, you know, there was a darkness about him right from the get-go. But, you know, it wasn't like he was a do-good guy who, after several years or something, you know, went down the tubes. Yeah, it was almost like he was always a gangster in a pinstripe suit or something.
Well, and it's interesting to think about Connolly growing up in that neighborhood, same neighborhood as the Bulgers. Here you have this very prominent politician in the family, obviously well-regarded in the neighborhood, and William Bulger, Whitey's younger brother. And even as a young man, Whitey Bulger was sort of kind of a neighborhood hero to people like John Connolly.
He was, and that's the thing that I think, you know, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, the FBI, if they fully understood these relationships and the fact that young John Connolly had grown up in awe of this teenage hellion named Whitey Bulger, who was, you know, kind of a hood and a legend among the kids and stuff, that's not the kind of dynamic you want in play when you have an agent who's supposed to be handling an older, smarter, you know, criminal genius. And as we now know, it did go bad really fast. That's a combustible, unwieldy, uncontrollable situation, I think, by definition, in its start. And that's what we've learned, again, from the benefit of hindsight.
So Whitey's younger brother, William Bulger, who was president of the Massachusetts Senate and who was forced out as president of Massachusetts State University by then-Governor Mitt Romney, he's a prominent part of the movie. He's a prominent part of the story. He's maintained that he has had no involvement with his brother's criminal life. Have you heard feedback from William Bulger about what your books say about him and how his image has treated him now that his career is, you know, wound down?
And he's retired? No, we haven't. And it's no surprise there. Whether it's our book or other journalism about this epic saga, he does not engage in conversations about it. And, you know, that's one of the parts of the story. I don't think we'll ever get the whole story because neither Whitey or Bill will provide it. But it is the extent to which their lives overlapped, their respective worlds. Because we have documented in Black Mass and in other journalistic accounts the points of intersection. It's been established that Bill Bulger certainly knew about a partnership going on between Whitey and the FBI. But, you know, the scope of that, the degree to which, I think, you know, he didn't want to know, but he knew as a fact that there was a partnership underway.
Do you think that there is any evidence to suggest that the FBI had a little bit more of impunity because of that, that they could develop Whitey as a contact and protect him because of the fact that his brother was so prominently politically connected?
Well, that goes back to the what I'll call a triangle, three legs of the stool. I mean, John Connolly really drills down or distills down to personal relationships. Because Connolly, again, knew Bill Bulger very well. He worked on Bill Bulger's first political campaign when John Connolly was just a college-age kid. And so there's just a long personal history between both Bulgers. And I think they all play off of those relationships in respective worlds to their mutual benefit for a while, until it started to unravel, and luckily for everyone, came undone.
We're talking with former Boston Globe reporter Dick Lehr, who's co-authored several best-selling books about James Whitey Bulger, the notorious gangster based out of Boston. One of those books, Black Mass, is now a movie. Well, Bulger's such a fascinating character in how he was able to manipulate and essentially run his reign of terror when he was on the loose. It's not in Black Mass, but in one of your other books, you uncovered that as a younger man, when Whitey Bulger was in prison, he became part of an LSD experimentation project. This is an interesting and strange chapter in this guy's story.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing about when we wrote a biography, a sequel to Black Mass. It's called, you know, Whitey. And you sort of climb on his back and you take this crazy ride through the 20th century because, you know, he's 86 now. He's lived a long life in a profession where there's a short shelf life. And part of that is just what you're alluding to. While he was in prison in the 1950s, he volunteered for these LSD experiments that were a part of it was very public and in for the public good. Doctors were trying to find a cure for schizophrenia. And this new drug called LSD, which had just emerged, doctors had discovered, went to it because it seemed like when you're tripping, you're hallucinating, you seemed instantly insane, as if you had schizophrenia. So they had students volunteering. They had prison inmates like Whitey Bulger, who would get $2 a day and 2 days off his sentence for volunteering. And the idea was to then, once you're tripping, is to try different drugs on you to see if it helped the symptoms. And this was all part of this unbelievable effort to deal with the public health problem, schizophrenia. And so, you know, Whitey tripped over like 50 times or something in a year and a half. And the flip side, which was not known at the time, was the secret CIA's role in these experiments. Because this is the height of the Cold War, and the CIA got interested in, mind control and truth serums and stuff like that. So secretly, they were partnering up with a lot of these doctors who were doing the schizophrenia testing and funneling other drugs to them to see if, can we use this for interrogation purposes? So it becomes, another whole dark mass. That kind of experiment. And like I say, when you're with Whitey Bulger, you end up going to these strange places. He spent up time in Alcatraz, the notorious prison of all time. And so you study and get a piece of Alcatraz in his life story. You know, he's really, when it comes to crime figures in American history, one of the things we argue is that he's, the most notorious in the last century.
Were you surprised when he was captured in 2011? You'd been covering him for so long.
Yeah, and every once in a while his name would come up because he disappeared in 1995, and here it is, 2011, and you just go, oh my God, finally, a good day for justice. But that was the water cooler conversation on and off for years. Where's Whitey? And no one had any, inside. It was people talking about, is he dead? Is he in Europe? And, it turns out all this time he was hiding in plain sight as a retiree in Santa Monica, California.
Dick Lehr is the co-author of Black Mass and a number of books that cover the criminal history of Whitey Bulger, and he's been talking to us this hour. The book, as you may have seen, has been turned into the motion picture, also called Black Mass, starring Johnny Depp. Dick, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.